this week. Don't tell anyone. But our guest is the writer of the new Steven Spielberg movie, Disclosure Day, David Koepp. Shh. It's David Koepp.
Right. But right. You just told them.
Why are we keeping it a secret?
Because it's Disclosure Day.
But surely you would be disclosing it.
Wait a second. Shit. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is delighted to see that also out this week is a film starring none other than Peter Mullen.
Peter Mullen.
Peter Mullen.
Peter Mullen.
Peter Mullen. Peter Mullen. Peter Mullen.
Which is nice, isn't it? That's exciting. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning in the pod booth. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I have to say that every week it is written down.
Yes, it is, yes.
Contractual small talk with Helen, wow. Box ticked. Next up is the mad titan of movies himself, otherwise known as Conan Sword Guy. He is, of course, James Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, James. How are you?
I am well. I'm still feeling a little uncomfortable because we've just done a photo shoot and you stood very, very close to me. Closer, really, than you're technically allowed to.
Clothed, though.
It was a lot of bumping and grinding.
Yeah, yeah. Helen and James and I just did a photo shoot
for the Empire calendar, podcast. Fully nude.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
We discussed this.
With the blancmange placed in a very tasteful position so you can see my junk.
Yeah, that's true. The anti-Austin Powers, that was good positioning.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
What?
I'm
the cup of tea in the saucer, so you know, just the station 3 feet to the right of my nipples.
Oh, matron.
That'd be an amazing calendar. Please let us know if you would like to see the Empire Podcast.
Yes, and how much you would pay for us not to put that out, because we will accept any kind of bribes.
Should we say, I guess we shouldn't say quite yet, maybe next week we can reveal, or the week after we can reveal why we were doing a photo shoot, but we will say that exciting times are coming. We can say, that's so exciting, Helen just yawned on the
Literally actively bored by what you're saying. Exciting times.
Did someone say exciting? Times.
Yeah, I'm very tired.
I'm so tired of the prospect of the exciting times. When are they getting here?
When are the times going to get exciting?
Soon, Helen. Very soon.
But yes, I think on next week's podcast, we can reveal the exciting times.
Yes, exciting times. Exciting times.
Yes, really exciting times are coming to the Empire Podcast.
It's exciting. It's exciting. Anyway, how are you both? I've done that. Should we have a question?
Sure.
Let's do it. So this question was meant to be last week's question, and then it was waylaid by a question about movie swords, which we talked about for half an hour.
We did. Solid. Did it all make it in?
No.
Okay.
Quite a lot of stuff was cut out, although I did leave in us getting the MCU wrong. I don't think it's a great sword in the MCU, and then people were going, what about this, you fucking dickhead, and sent me pictures of Thanos with his big sword out. But yeah. I think that's a great big sword.
That's a sword.
I don't know if it's a great sword. Is it?
It's about the size of Sir John DeLuth.
Yeah, but it's very similar in size and appearance to the one you were talking about.
It's more like a propeller than a sword.
I think that's what it is, isn't it?
It's like a prop.
Yeah.
Is that the idea that it's like almost like a helicopter propeller that has crashed and he's taken it?
He's taken it. Yeah, it's like a double-ended glaive thing. I don't know what it is. I think you've 100%
made that up.
I don't think I made it up.
It's a completely different shape from the glaive.
Not the glaive, a glaive. I don't know.
Anyway,
okay.
That was a fun conversation about movie swords. And this week's question, most meticulously organized character since Chris doesn't have a calendar. It's true. I don't have a calendar and I never will.
That is true. That is one of the weirdest things about you. You employ no form of organizational tool.
I do. It's called the human brain. It's the most powerful computer on the planet.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
What was the gig that you missed again?
What gig?
The one that you forgot about because you didn't have a calendar.
Which one?
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Oh my God. There is a solution to this, Chris. I don't know if you spotted it.
Is it a calendar?
It is a calendar.
Yeah, but here's the problem. I wrote down in my calendar by calendar and then I forgot to look at the calendar because I didn't have a calendar.
That's what it is.
The League of Steve says, is Spielberg's DFS Closure Day about sofas from space? Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
I can't find the question, so please continue to talk amongst yourselves.
You told us what it was, though.
I know, but I want to credit the person who sent it in. It was something about moving. Here it is.
Okay.
Joshua Reynolds.
The painter.
As it's warmer now, what holiday slash trip in film would you like to go on? So we're immediately ruling out bad holidays and bad trips, not that kind.
Okay.
It's kind of where you go on a plane and then go somewhere and then consume a load of mushrooms, that sort of trip. We are talking about holidays you would like to go on. So, James, you cannot say aliens for this.
Are you trying to tell me that LV-426 is not a desirable getaway location for a mini break?
I mean,
absolutely not.
That was the plan. The plan was to terraform it. And then for reasons unknown... the whole thing went wrong.
Yeah.
Flaston Paradise!
That's a good answer.
The thing is, I don't know anything about Flaston Paradise itself, except that it's like a beach planet, I guess. And beach planets are not really my jam, but I just really enjoy the idea of going
Flaston
on an
Paradise
alien
the
cruise
ship?
Ship. No, they're going to Flaston Paradise, I believe.
Are they? Yeah. I thought it was the ship that
I don't,
was called
I don't
that.
Think Flaston Paradise
right.
is the
I'm,
ship.
I'm looking it up, okay. You fucks.
James is looking it up, you fucks.
The iconic ultra-luxurious floating cruise ship and resort from the 1997 sci-fi film The Fifth Element. It was, in fact, the ship is Flaston Paradise.
Above the ocean planet of Flaston, which is a paradise. So we're both right.
Oh, I see.
Let's move on.
I see.
All right.
Mm. Okay.
And this is from The Fifth Element, just to be absolutely clear.
This is from The Fifth Element, where Bruce Willis's cab driver unexpectedly wins, in inverted commas, a trip to Flaston Paradise, on the Flaston Paradise. And of course, it's a setup to get him there for reasons, which we won't go into.
Not for reasons. Oh, no, that doesn't work.
That's a different one. Anyway, it's a setup actually to get someone else there. But the point is, they need to get on that ship and talk to the diva, Plava yes. Laguna.
And we all said, Flaston Paradise!
Like that because of Ruby Rod. Who
played
is
by
the Chris Tucker
yes.
DJ, who's like a super huge celebrity and incredibly well-dressed.
Yes.
One
of the most
is...
spectacularly annoying characters in,
cinema. Yes, he is, but then he is also meant to be, so I will allow him that. I love that film a lot, and I think that Flaston Paradise, the ship, looks amazing, and I would also quite like to go on a space cruise.
A space cruise sounds nice.
Yeah.
We've been on a space cruise of kind,
that's true.
Haven't we?
Yeah,
the
we went.
The Star Cruiser? I can't even remember what it's called. This is great. I mean, the thing's closed down now. A Galactic Star Cruiser.
The Galactic Star Cruiser.
It's closed down,
yes.
So it doesn't matter now.
Yeah. Yes, but we still went on it.
We did go. The two things may be connected.
Yeah. I'm struggling with this one because all I can think of is terrible holidays.
Wow.
Holidays that go wrong. Because there are things like couples retreat and forgetting Sarah Marshall where people go to really beautiful places.
But have a horrible time.
Well, not necessarily. Sometimes they have a really, really lovely time. But I don't, you know, I'd love to do that holiday in real. Oh, this is the question, isn't it?
Were this the Pilot TV podcast, I might suggest the White Lotus. But of course, I've been to the White Lotus because you sent me there last year.
But which one would you want to go to?
The Thai White Lotus.
No, but which one would you want to go to?
The Thai White Lotus. I'd like to go back. Please, can you send me back? I want to go back.
I do quite fancy the French one, I assume.
Or the Italian one.
No, well, they haven't made
the French one.
The
French one is the new one, yeah.
Yeah, but like if it's based on the Cap Ferrat, that's going to be pretty swish.
So which ones have there been so far?
There has been, so the first one was Hawaii.
Yeah.
Then
like
Thailand.
Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Then
it was Italy, and then Thailand.
Was it Sicily?
And then it's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
But Beth stayed at that hotel.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. One by one.
We
were
all
Empire.
Staying. Yeah.
Would you want to be murdered?
I mean, not ideally.
On this, no?
If that were the cost of going, I'd consider it. But
yeah, I'd like to stay in the hotel from The Shining because, you know, incredible scenery.
Ooh, yes.
and beautiful hotel. I've been in one of the hotels that inspired it in Yosemite, but I don't want ghosts. So it is
true.
A bit of a tough call there.
We'll say it's not a holiday.
It's not.
It's more of a job.
Yeah, I guess so. But I would actually quite like that sort of, oh, let's go there for the season. If they're, again, not for the malignant ghosts.
All now, work and no play makes Helen a dull girl.
I hate to say it, especially because I literally was almost Googling a holiday like this, but I have watched, as people who listen to the Pilot TV podcast will know, 4.5 seasons of Yellowstone in the past fortnight. And as a result, I very much wanted to do a City Slickers type getaway.
Right.
Where Ooh, you, that'd be fun.
Yeah, right. So me and Jack Palance driving yeah. cattle across the range, it'd be great.
I have kind of done that when I went to stay on a ranch beside the Grand Canyon for a couple of days once with my friend Laura. Hello, Laura.
Did you drive cattle?
No, but we did go out on horse rides. And on one of those occasions, we were scared by a rattlesnake.
Oh.
So that was quite exciting. Maybe
describe
too exciting.
Describe that to me. Explain that. Well, what do
we
you
were,
mean
we
scared
were riding
by a
along in, there were three of us, a cowboy and dun, Laura dun, and myself. Dun, dun, dun. I was humming that to myself under my breath, correct? Blue moon. Anyway, and we heard a hiss and the horses reacted. And then the cowboy went and took care of the rattlesnake for us.
What do you mean he took care of it? He fucked it.
Well, no. Ew, what? Why would that be your go-to for that phrase?
No, no reason. Tell
okay.
me, tell me.
Did, he, so did he pick it up and bite the tail off?
No, but he... He basically held it there with a stick until someone from the ranch kind of followed us out in an ATV and took it because they have like a
Steve
sort
Irwin
of kind
or
of
Rick
thing,
Wheeler.
Yeah, yeah. Because they basically have a little zoo at the back of the ranch with all of these like rattlesnakes and stuff that they have collected from the surrounding area so that they won't eat the horses or the cattle. Well, it was a proper dude ranch.
It would have to be a rattlesnake the size of a bus to be able to eat a horse.
Be like
but
anaconda.
I understand, yeah.
Well, you understand it wouldn't eat the horse, but it could still bite the horse.
Yes.
Which could cause pain and suffering to the horse.
Never bite the horse that feeds you.
I don't know if that's the rattlesnake motto, to
Never look a gift rattlesnake in the mouth.
Because it could bite you.
I actually wouldn't like to look any rattlesnake in the mouth again.
No, nor would I.
No.
I mean, did you actually look it in the mouth? I'm fascinated
by
rattlesnakes.
I stayed quite a long way away from it, to be honest. It was uncomfortable.
It's a tip nipper.
It's a cock biter.
Anyway, it was more like we were in Utah, the north rim of the Grand Canyon. I'm not sure that's the exact accent, but I appreciate
it. I think it is. I beg to differ. I think this is
All
the
right.
exact accent.
That's the one.
That,
yep. All right.
There's a snake in my boot.
Someone's poisoned a water hole.
Well, you are a week ahead of the movies this week.
We are. It's true.
Anyway, yeah. So I quite like that kind of. You know, holiday.
Yes,
we slept
slickers.
In little tiny sort of covered wagons. It was
Did
cute.
You?
Yeah, it was really cute.
Amazing.
Wow.
That sounds great.
Home on the range.
Indeed. Any more for any more?
Were I being particularly me, I might say that Arrakis is the very nicest time of year. Could take a dune holiday.
James.
At what point in the Dune movies do they go on holiday?
Well,
I refer you to the question.
Yeah, he did specify holiday.
Yes.
To be fair,
holiday slash trip in film would you like to go on?
Paul and Jessica do go camping.
Yeah, they are at one point in a tent.
They are running for their lives.
I mean, you say that.
It is a survival situation, like Chris is correct.
It's a mini movie.
Yeah.
Okay. I might go to possibly Palm Springs in an infinite time loop.
Ooh.
So I would be forever in Palm Springs.
I've been to Palm Springs as well, and it was nice, and that might not be terrible.
Did you go there again? And again?
And again?
And again? And again?
It'd be awful, though. You'd just get to do nothing but fall in love with Christina Milioti every day. I mean, that would be awful.
And get shot in
or
the ass by J.K. Simmons.
Or Andy Samberg. Like, what a trial. Oh, my God.
I mean... I've had worse holidays. Holidays in movies tend to end badly because that's where the conflict and the drama comes from. You're not going to have a movie about people having a lovely time on holiday in the end.
It happens. It happens more in the sort of rom-coms that you maybe don't watch.
Okay.
You know, that Tuscany one with Diane Lane, for example.
You mean Under the Tuscan Sun?
That's the one.
What's that one where she's under the Tuscan Sun?
Like it's sunny and it's in Tuscany.
Well,
that is
a
good one, actually.
Is
that a holiday? Does she go on holiday there?
Isn't that a holiday? I think it's a holiday.
Did they go on holiday?
How Stella Got Her Groove Back. Isn't that a holiday?
That's fried holiday. Green tomatoes in the Whistle Stop Cafe.
I don't think that's a holiday.
Eat, Pray, Love.
I thought we were just doing long titles.
Eat, Pray, Love is definitely a holiday.
Eat, Pray, Love is a holiday, but also a lamentably terrible film.
It is a terrible film, but would be a good experience because you just go to, first of all, you go to Italy and eat lots of pizza.
Oh, she's selling it.
And then you go, so what was that? It was Italy, there was Bali.
They go to
Bali. Was that not Love?
I don't know.
So what was Pray?
Pray. That was the Take That song.
All I Do Each Night.
Yeah. I think it's the Predator prequel.
Yeah.
That's true as well.
That would be a great film.
Anyway.
Pray with an E, Love. Now, that's a film I'd watch.
Julia Roberts fighting the Predator.
Do you know what? She's genuinely overdue a Jerry Actioner.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Yes.
100%.
That would be great.
How old is she?
She's no older than...
She's got to be only mid-50s. That's not Jerry Actioner.
She's,
you think?
She's, I mean, look, Keanu was mid-50s for the first John Wick, so just saying. Jerry Action is surely anything over 50.
Kenny was mid-late 40s, surely, for the first John
Wick. I don't know. He's north of 60 now, so.
Is he north of 60? Keanu?
Yep.
Keanu Reeves? From Toronto, impossible. Canada? The same.
How many other Keanu's? Actually, there is Keanu Wayans. I discovered in the credits to Scary Movie the other day.
That's right, yeah.
Would you go to Skull Island?
No, it's not a holiday.
Bugs. Giant bugs.
Safari.
Giant bugs.
What part of this question are you struggling with?
I like adventure holidays.
So there's a lot of holidays. I mean, I wrote down some, but they all end badly. So every holiday that the Griswolds take in the Vacation series ends badly. But all of those ones, you know, there's obviously the stay-at-home one in Christmas Vacation. Yeah. They go to Vegas in Vegas Vacation, they go to Europe in European Vacation, and they just go to Wally World in Vacation. But of course, along the way, lots of bad shit happens to them. Clark jumps into a cold swimming pool, the grandmother dies, you know, they run over a dog. There's lots of stuff that happens in that movie. In Europe, they run over Eric Idle a couple of times, and they get trapped in traffic at a roundabout. So which of those? I think I'd go for the Europe one.
Yeah, Europe is definitely the one to go for.
Yeah, because they get a little bit more culture.
Lower body count. And look kids, Big Ben. Yeah. You know, so.
Parliament.
Houses of Parliament.
Yeah. Yeah.
Big Ben.
I would like to go to Vienna as in Before Sunrise and just wander the streets.
Oh, that's a good answer.
That's a good answer.
And talk about pretentious philosophy.
Any of the Before trilogy actually would be
Paris.
Would be great. Yeah.
Where are they living in?
They're on holiday in Greece.
Right.
I think. Or possibly Turkey, but I think Greece.
Or we could go to Kefalonia, like Captain Corelli.
Principe. No, I don't know about that.
I mean, that's.
It's not really a holiday, is it? Because what with them being at war.
Is Mamma Mia a holiday?
Mamma Mia is definitely a holiday. And actually would be a blast.
Is that a good one? Where three people turn up and, you know, five for the right to be your dad?
I mean, I'm not sure about that bit, but I'd quite like. I could just be like the sort of Christine Baranski just singing along in the background.
Or,
even better, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. And then at the end of your holiday, Cher turns up and sings a duet with Andy, Garcia.
Andy Garcia. Fernando.
That would be amazing.
Other holidays gone awry that I've written down here. Technically, James, you're not allowed to mention Aliens.
So you said.
But
you're not allowed to mention Evil Dead.
You say that.
That's not a holiday.
It is a holiday.
They're literally going on holiday.
That's a holiday cabin.
That's what they're doing.
That's a terrible
cabin. Ash is on holiday throughout Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, and indeed Army of Darkness. So you could count those, but they're bad holidays.
They're bad
holidays.
And
I wouldn't want to take those holidays.
Yeah, even on the page, they're bad holidays because, like, it's not a luxurious cabin. Like, Cabin in the Woods, it's a nicer cabin, at least.
Yeah.
You know?
It does, you know, invoke the old gods.
Okay.
But
again, I think there's some downsides to it. It wouldn't be top of my list.
Fucking merman.
With Nell and I, of course, famously go on holiday by mistake.
We've gone on holiday by mistake.
Yeah, but again, it's a terrible holiday.
Terrible holiday. Bad
Penrith.
Weather.
Penrith!
Looks beautiful this time of year, I have to say. All right, so very quick run through some franchises.
Okay.
Do they take any holidays in Star Wars?
I was thinking about this, and no, I can't think of... Technically, the planet that they go to in... Rise of Skywalker, where they're having that big old rave, is probably the closest to a holiday planet.
The rave?
Yeah.
I don't remember a rave.
Do you not remember? There's like a hippie rave in Rise of Skywalker.
Is that Tatooine or is that a
desert planet?
Every Star Wars planet is just one thing. The casino planet is probably
Canto Bight. Yes,
more
could
of
be
a
Canto Bight. That's true.
But again,
not a great holiday.
DJ and Rose and Finn are not going.
They're not going
on
there on holiday. Star Trek, they have holidays.
Yeah, but not in the films.
Holodex.
Yes, they do actually.
Riser doesn't appear in the films.
I didn't say Riser.
Go on then.
Yosemite.
Oh, come
at the start of Star Trek V.
Is that a holiday?
Yeah.
He's rock climbing.
He is
on a break.
Free soloing.
We were on a break.
On a break.
As is Ethan Hunt at the beginning Mission Impossible 2.
In the exact same place.
I refuse to believe Ethan Hunt takes time off.
It's not the same place.
Is it not?
It's clearly not the same place.
It's exactly the same place.
It's a totally different rock.
All rocks, Helen, are the same.
At the beginning of Mission Impossible 2, he's in Utah where they all talk like these.
They do.
As you've established.
Yeah.
Whereas Yosemite is clearly in California.
Sure.
Correct.
California where they all talk like these.
They do.
Oh, God. We're going to get some letters now. Anyway, he is free soloing El Capitan.
But also, we don't count that particular Star Trek fight
because it's very bad.
Because it's so bad.
That scene is good.
It's a good scene.
And then his buddies turn up to rescue him when he falls off the cliff. Spoiler.
Okay, other franchises, Bond. Bond, he's always jet-setting. He's always globe-trotting. He's racking up the air miles. But does he actually go on holiday at any time?
Yes, sometimes at the end of movies.
Sometimes at the end of movies. I don't know. He's taken a day off to have wild intercourse with whatever lady he's just picked up in the course of his adventures.
Yeah, he's staying in a very swanky hotel in Istanbul, for example. Oh, I think he is legitimately on holiday when he goes to Venice with Eva Green.
Because he's had his ball smashed in by the chief.
Yeah, he has.
Yes. Yeah, he has to give him time to grow back.
Reflate.
Yes. she's pair of bellows. That's the noise you make when you reinflate James Bond's testicles.
Sure.
That's a good one, Helen. Yes, he is he's convalescing because of the flattened balls.
No follow-up questions.
Yes, the medical term.
Objection sustained. So that's a good one. MCU. Holidays in the MCU.
Oh, there's got to be.
There is.
Okay.
Spider-Man!
Far from home.
That's true. That's a school trip, I guess. Is that a holiday or is it a learning experience?
Yeah.
It's a holiday,
I imagine.
It doesn't
feel much like a holiday. It doesn't go right.
It's a summer break. And again, it doesn't go wrong. He has a lovely time. He goes to Prague, he goes to Amsterdam or somewhere near Amsterdam.
Makes no sense whatsoever. He goes to Venice as well.
Venice, he goes to London. It's a lovely time. He has a lovely, lovely time.
I have been a tour guide, as you know, on school trips of that sort with young Americans coming over to Europe and seeing the place. I would submit that we do a lot of cultural activities on those, which suggest to me that they are learning and they are led by teachers.
Yeah, I've heard tell tour guide, that's not a fucking holiday.
Have you ever had these small children fight Mysterio?
Not during the bit where I was with them, but they do have free time every day and they are free to fight Mysterio during their free time.
All right.
Well, or any other supervillains who happen to be around. I'm not picky.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Listen, should we bring this to a close?
Sure.
Let's do it. So I don't think we provided the definitive answer there whatsoever.
but we
listed a whole bunch of films and I nailed the Utah accent.
You did.
And the California accent.
And the California accent as well. They all sound like that in California.
All right. So if you want to have your question read out in the Emperor podcast, I'm on Instagram, CTAH1976 is the name. And wait for a kind of semi-panicked shout out next week for flooding my inbox with your excellent questions. So thank you so much indeed to Joshua Reynolds. Oh, Josh A. Reynolds.
Oh, that's different. He's not a painter.
No, he's not a painter. He's just Josh A. Reynolds. So that's far less impressive. But thank you, Josh, for your excellent question. Sorry about our frankly, shitty fucking answers. Shall we have a little break?
Hurrah.
Let's have a little break and we'll be back in a second to talk about the movie news. Hold on to your hats. It's a big week.
The days are longer, the calendar is filling up, and I want to feel as good as this beautiful summer weather. That's why I've been loving Grunes. It's one daily pack of gummies that covers my greens, vitamins, minerals, and even has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, so I don't need to juggle a complicated wellness routine on top of everything else. They taste amazing, they're easy to toss in my bag on the go, plus they're vegan, gluten-free, and HSA and FSA, eligible for reimbursement. Save up to 52% off with code PODCAST at grunes.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS.co.
All right, we are back, folks. We are back, and now it is time to delve deep into the week's movie news. And where should we start? Should we start with the news that there's going to be a new 21 Jump Street movie, but it's not going to be called 21 Jump Street because that title's been taken, nor is it going to be called 22 Jump Street because that title's been taken, and it's certainly not going to be called 23 Jump Street. No, instead it's going to be called 24 Jump Street. Now, Ben, what did you think about this?
This is classic.
Hang on a second. Ben, what?
Yes.
What are you doing here?
I beamed in.
You beamed in. Oh, I know what's happened. We've had to come in the next day to record a bit about the 20 for Jump Street News, and Helen's not here, so you are doing your best Helen impression to come in and talk about this with me and Jimbo. Hello, Jimbo.
Wait.
Hi, Chris.
You guys recorded yesterday without me?
Okay, moving swiftly on. So, Ben, what did you think about the 24 Jump Street revelation?
Yeah, this is classic Jump Street stuff. It's smart and it's silly at the same time.
It's clean and rad and powerful.
Clean and rad and powerful. They've said they waited too long to do 23 Jump Street, so they're just skipping straight to 24 Jump Street.
And is this going to be 24 Jump Street foreign exchange students, as promised at the end of 22 Jump Street?
Yes. Oh, that would be great.
That's got one of the great credit sequences, isn't it?
One of the greatest, yes.
At the end of 22 Jump Street, where they imagine all the various cash-in sequels that they're going to do, including going to the moon and space, yes. And animated.
23 Jump Street medical school. 24 Jump Street foreign exchange students, then it's a semester at sea, art school, culinary school, veterinary school, Sunday school.
Oh my God.
It's so genius. I have missed Lord and Miller in this zone. Like, I loved Project Hail Mary. We all love Spider-Verse and we can't wait for Beyond the Spider-Verse, but they had such a great thing going with these Jump Street movies. Obviously, 21 Jump Street, nobody saw it coming, how good that was going to be.
Yeah.
And then doing 22 Jump Street is like, they hopped so quickly into it. And you just felt like they were in the zone. They had such a good thing going.
Yeah.
And hopefully, I mean, they've got all the right people involved. Because
so they're not directing this one, is that
no,
right?
No, they're not going to direct, but they've got Rodney Rothman directing.
Oh, yeah.
He was one of the directors on Into the Spider-Verse. So he's very much in the Lord and Miller realm.
Mm, and co-wrote, I think, 22 Jump Street with him, certainly.
Right, and Lord and Miller are producing this. This is happening sort of within their sphere of creativity. And there's a script that exists. Rodney Rothman has written it with Jonah Hill and also with Megan Malloy. And Neil Moritz, who is one of the producers, has put a photo on his Instagram of the script with the 24 Jump Street page saying, "It took so long to make, we had to skip one."
Because it's been a while. Jimbo, how long is it since
so long.
22 Jump Street?
I don't know. What year was it? It feels like it's been fucking
2014,
decades.
I think.
No.
Wow, 2014. So from the before times.
No way.
Even before the before,
before
times.
Before the before. So far before the before times. Jesus Christ, that is over a decade ago. I feel so old.
I mean, it'll be interesting because, you know, Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum have been on different sort of creative paths over that time.
Yep.
I have for a long time been a Jonah Hill fan and maybe slightly less so in recent years. So I'm intrigued to see how he gets back into this zone.
I mean, the question, and obviously this will be addressed, but obviously the premise of this, it is young looking police officers going undercover in schools or universities or, you know, whatever you want to do. Given that Jonah Hill now looks around 65, I'm not quite sure, is he going to be going undercover in a large multinational conglomerate? Like, what's it going to be?
In an old person's home.
Perhaps it's that, although Ted Danson's already done that.
I mean, so, I would love it if they just made it part of the joke that they are going back into a school and looking, which they already did in the previous films, that they already look too old. And you would hope as well that a lot of the jokes in this will be them flashing back to things that we never saw from the 23 Jump Street that was never made.
Oh, that would be good. I hope they do that, yeah.
But there were talks, weren't there, about where Jump Street would have gone after 22 Jump Street, despite that hilarious kind of credit sequence to that film, because we don't condone the leaks, but in the Sony leaks, there was interesting, juicy stuff. There was the preposition of a Jump Street Men in Black crossover movie, which is where Jonah Hill was quoted as saying, "It's clean and rad and powerful." And it was a clean and rad and powerful idea.
It was.
I'm sad that never happened.
And was better than the Men in Black sequel that they actually made.
Most things are better than Men in Black International.
Yeah, this is very, very true. And you're absolutely right. Jonah Hill's last movie, Outcome, which was on Apple, and he directed it as well, didn't really make much of an impact. And you could argue cynically that maybe he needs a hit, but maybe they'll riff on that as well. There are no sacred cows in these movies. Absolutely everything. They have Cate Blanchett with the budget and they have Cate Blanchett with the targets as well. And so maybe they'll be very, very meta about that also. Maybe it'll be about Schmidt and Jenko, who are the Hill and Tatum characters, kind of being on their outs in a way and needing a hit to get back in to the cop scene. So maybe it's about that.
I'm still holding out for 2121 Jump Street.
Which one was that?
The future one.
Was that the one? There was one in space. Or was one
there
have
been a few, but that was the last one. I think it goes 43 Jump Street Mariachi School, and then the final one is 2121 Jump Street.
Isn't there like a prequel as well? There's like a high school one where
military school, dance academy, magic school, beauty school, 34 Jump Street, Return of the Ghost. Sure. It's with 31 Jump Street Ninja Academy.
Yes, I would love to see these films. That's a great idea. I'm excited about this. Very, very excited about this indeed. So there we go. Yeah. Well, guys, thanks for joining me. Shall we segue smoothly back to yesterday's record, where we were starting to talk about Treasure Island, a new version of Treasure Island that begins with the acclaimed English writer Jack Thorne. So hopefully there'll be a seamless segue to us talking about that now. Jack Thorne, he's going to team up with Ridley Scott.
All right.
And Hugh Jackman.
All right.
For a new adaptation of Robert Louis Stevenson's, now, it can only be one of two pretty much at this point. What do you think it is?
I think it's Treasure Island.
Because you read it earlier in the week.
Yes.
Yes, okay. It's Treasure Island.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I'm so shocked.
I know. I presume that Hugh Jackman will play Long John Silver, right?
Yeah, presumably. Yeah?
Okay. So, Helen, for people who don't know, can you quickly tell them the non-Muppet version?
I was about to say, it's a remake of Muppet Treasure Island is what it is.
It might be the first Treasure Island movie since Muppet Treasure Island, and certainly there weren't that many before it. This hasn't been touched on the big screen for a while.
Treasure Planet, maybe?
Yeah.
Big screen, technically, if we're going like sci-fi
version.
That is
true.
But yeah, it's basically a little boy called Jim Hawkins, goes off to search for buried treasure with people, including a kindly cook called Long John Silver, who only has one leg and a parrot. The two are not connected. Like, the leg is missing, but the parrot's on his shoulder. He uses the parrot as a leg.
Did he cook his leg?
It's not specified to my memory in the text, but it has been a long time since I read it.
Like, so, in the Stephen King story, Survivor type.
Yeah, I don't think so. Anyway, and what do you know? It turns out that Long John Silver is actually a baddin.
No!
I know, and he's after the treasure for himself.
Oh, what a prick.
Oh, the worst.
It is a classic, classic tale. I haven't read it in a long time.
I think I was at school when I read it, so it's been a minute. But this could be fun.
You can see a Ridley Scott version of this?
Yeah, I think so.
With Hugh Jackman. I mean, the last time he played a
Blackbeard.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to gloss over that.
Just draw a veil.
Look, you're allowed to go on a ship more than once in your career and play a different kind of sailor character. It's fine.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
Are we going back into our pirate era? Because isn't there another Pirates of the Caribbean stewing at the moment?
Is there?
Mm.
And there may or may not, I don't know, but there may or may not be pirates in the new season of House of the Dragon. Taroshi pirates.
Oh,
you saw it
really?
Set up last time. So,
well, the sea snake will make short work of them.
Well, you'd hope so, but let's see.
I've got a very good pirate joke. Do you want to ask me?
Hey, Chris.
Okay. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Good. Yes.
Hey, Chris.
What is a pirate's favorite German football team?
What's a pirate's favorite German football
team? Very specific.
RB Leipzig. There's a German team called RB Leipzig.
That was your good one?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Do you want another one?
Okay. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris. What's a pirate's favorite Austrian football team? RB Salzburg.
Okay. I sense a theme here.
Okay. I've run out of RB clubs.
That's
good. I'm excited about this. This is fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You best start believing you in pirate stories,
in pirate
Mr. Jackman.
Stories,
you're in one.
Mr. Hawkins.
Yes, indeed. Well, we got there in the end. So, well done.
Speaking of people who are the worst.
Hi.
Which for some reason Chris's jokes reminded me of. The Social Reckoning trailer is out.
I thought you'd be segueing into Ridley Scott because the Dog Stars trailer was out this week.
Oh, that's right. I saw that as well.
We could have done. We chose not to.
No, that's, you know,
well, he's not the worst.
Because we were talking about Ridley Scott. Segue into Ridley Scott. But no, it's fine.
Then segue into the worst.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go on, Helen.
Well, the social.
Take it away. This is obviously directed by Aaron Sorkin, who directed the 4-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game. But
three stars.
Take it away.
And that, honestly, I'm considering taking one off because you keep harping on about it. But yes, so this is the sequel to The Social Network. We now have, as Mark Zuckerberg, Jeremy Strong with an even more disturbing haircut than usual, it has to be said. Mikey Madsen plays the whistleblower Francis Hogan, and Jeremy Allen White is the reporter Jeff
Bruce
Horwitz.
Yes, Bruce Springsteen. I was surprised that Bruce Springsteen was in this particular story.
He's his own man.
Wow. Yeah.
And I heard him, and I thought it's Rot of the Hut.
Yeah,
I know. It's just uncanny, isn't it? And then Wumi Masaku is in there, Betty Gilpin, Billy Magnussen, Bill Burr. Really, really good cast. Mm. It's, I've got to say, it's looking pretty good, and I enjoy any opportunity to... poke fun at our billionaire overlords who can all get in the bin.
Do you think it's like Pass the Parcel? Because Sorkin's doing Fincher, and Fincher's now doing Tarantino's sequel, and so everyone's just passing their films on
to Tarantino's going to direct the Sorkin script?
Molly's Game 2. Yeah, Molly's Games with a dollar sign.
Yeah. No. Yes, that's right. You walk into any studio in town, you write Molly's Game on a board, and then add a dollar to it. No one's going to invest that movie.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. Remember how much money Molly's Game made?
All the money.
We might be able to double it with this.
I'm excited about this film, not least of all because Aaron Sorkin is written and is directing it. It is, as you might imagine, beautifully written. But it's also...
How do you know?
Because I've seen the trailer. And it has sparkling dialogue.
The lines in the trailer are pretty.
You can't argue with that, Chris. You can't. That's science.
They're fine.
They're wonderful. Anyway. But it's also just like fury-inducing, and it's depressing, and it's bleak, and it does feel like the sort of the dark sequel. And bearing in mind that the first film wasn't exactly a fucking feel-good comedy.
You're not totally selling it to me.
No, but
I'm
in the best possible way.
Best possible depressing, dark.
The best possible nihilistic, bleak. Yeah, exactly that.
Awful reality, yeah.
I have slight quibbles about Jeremy Strong as Mark Zuckerberg. He looks like he's going to deliver a very, very good performance, and he will no doubt be Oscar nominated for it. I think he's too old.
I know what you mean, but he has big Zuck energy,
I would say. The issue I had with him in the Bruce Springsteen film, where he was meant to be this very empathetic character, and I don't get that from Jeremy Strong. I do get this from Jeremy Strong.
Yeah,
I get this awkward, slimy little weasel energy. No disrespect. He's an incredible actor, and I'm sure a wonderful person. But on screen, he has awful little weasel energy. And that's
like
perfect for
reptilian
Zuck.
Alien energy, which Zuckerberg really has.
Yeah.
So, I actually think it's really good casting. I get what you're saying from a kind of age perspective, but I'm pretty happy with it.
Mm.
Jesse Eisenberg obviously didn't want to come back, which is in some ways a shame because I think he was really, really good and incredibly unlikable in The Social Network. I'd like to have seen him do this, but I think Strong's a decent choice.
Mm. My other concern is that Sorkin as a director is not David Fincher as a director, but.
But who is?
I mean, Helen will obviously give this 3 stars, goes without saying, but, I'm excited.
Look,
about it. All right, let's
move
on.
Aaron Sorkin, but Molly's Game is not a good movie.
We're moving on.
Not a great movie.
We're not relitigating that again.
Fine.
So
also an Enola Holmes 3 trailer, which I'm sure we're all excited about.
Well, talking about Jack Thorne, right?
Yeah.
He wrote that. I'm sure he also wrote The Dog Stars. And,
and everything else.
And no doubt he did a pass on The Social Reckoning as well. Sorry, Aaron, you were missing a few bits there. I made some of the characters talk to each other. You just people staring at the wall wasn't very cinematic, so...
Jack Thorne always has multiple scripts on the go at any given time.
Does he?
Nice man.
Yes. I spoke to him about it. He said it's because if he hits a wall with one, he just pivots to the other one.
Yeah.
Does he ever get confused and then start porting over a character from one script into another?
It's entirely possible.
It is. Mm. So, Enola Holmes 3...
Yeah, well, she'd make short work of Mark Zuckerberg, really. So I would be all up for that.
Yeah. And this is the one in which Sherlock, played by Henry Cavill, goes missing.
No.
He's kidnapped.
No.
And Enola, soon to be Enola Tewkesbury.
Who's getting married?
That's right, she's getting married. Doesn't get to keep her name. To Tewkesbury.
To Tewkesbury.
Yeah.
Honestly. Keep up.
Pretend for a second I didn't see the second one.
He's landed gentry, don't you know?
He's her like sidekick. He's kind of her Watson.
Is he the Louis Partridge character?
Yes.
Yes.
Ah. Okay.
So she's getting married to him. She's on her way to the wedding. She's already got a few, reservations. What with the whole, now you'll be a lady and not a detective. And she's like, but I want to be a detective. And everyone's like, no, you couldn't possibly. You're going to be a lady. I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly. And then wouldn't you know it, on the way to the wedding, she discovers that Sherlock's been kidnapped and she has to swing into action to save him because he's like an enormous man mountain of a machine person, but he can't save himself, apparently.
Yes. Yes, I need my younger sister to help me get out of this one. Okay, I haven't seen it, but I'm going to guess this looks fun. This is directed by, of all people, Philip Barantini.
I know, which blew my mind.
He's directed Boiling Point.
I'd forgotten that he was making this, and I'm genuinely quite hyped to see it now.
So. It is not an Enola Holmes wonner. That would be a lot.
No.
That would be a lot, but not beyond his powers, I'm sure.
Yes. Okay, that's out on Netflix on July 1st. But The Dog Stars is the Ridley Scott movie that had a trailer this week.
Oh, yeah.
And stars Jacob Elordi. Mm-hmm. It's a post-apocalyptic thingy.
Yep.
In which he's trying desperately to stay alive. And Margaret Qualley is there. And Josh Brolin is there. And they all have a great time, as far as I can tell.
It doesn't look super great, but yeah, they're trying to keep it together and fly their little plane around and I guess get supplies and keep his dog alive and generally, you know, figure out a way forward in the world.
What did we think of it? Did we think it looked good?
I think it looks really good. I just don't really know exactly what the overall point of it is yet, but I'm excited to find out.
It had 28 years later vibes, but a much, much bigger budgeted version thereof. I don't know that these survivors who are kind of all feral are meant to be infected necessarily. Some of them are clearly just clans and tribes that have sprung up and you don't want to mess with these survivor clans. Mm. But one group of people that they run into in the trailer certainly had infected style movements.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's something going on there. I don't know what the apocalypse is that they're post in this movie, but maybe it's a virus. Who knows? Maybe. Who the fuck knows?
But I would say the trailer that I was most kind of blindsided by this week was Whalefall. Did you watch Whalefall?
Oh, yes.
Brian Duffield's film about a man, a scuba diver. Are you for scuba? No, because you might get eaten by a whale. Although the whale eats a squid and then the squid eats the guy. It's like I swallowed a guy to catch the squid.
Yeah, the squid was just kind of reaching out for something to kind of pull out and he just gets caught up in the squid.
And he goes full Jonah.
Yeah, and then he goes full Jonah. Mm. And then he is in the belly of the whale. I've read the book, and he's in the belly of the whale trying to figure a way out of the belly
Tickle
of the sperm
tonsils.
Whale.
Make
yeah,
it sneeze.
And he's also like, I'm fascinated by this film because most of the book, he is in the belly of the beast, and there is no light, there is no space, he cannot move. He is completely just squished into place. He knows his air is running out. He also begins to suspect that the whale is diving. And it's diving because sperm whales apparently do this when they're going to die. They dive to enormous depths. And he's beginning to worry that that's what's happening and that he's going to be crushed. So even if he got out of the whale somehow, he's still way below the surface of the water and unable to survive. So he's kind of got a lot of different problems to deal with. Plus, he's having flashbacks to all of his father issues throughout his life, which is the Josh Brolin character in the trailer, as you've seen. It's going to be a fascinating challenge, let us say, to explain what the fuck is going on. And I'm genuinely wondering, are they going to have a voiceover of his inner monologue? Because how else do you explain from one second to the next what's happening?
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know. There's going to be,
maybe
I'm guessing,
just talks to himself?
But he's got a thing in his mouth, he's literally scuba diving.
I thought he had some sort of mask on or something.
From the trailer we saw, it doesn't even look like they've gone with one of those. So there will, I'm sure, like the book, be frequent flashbacks to give you reprieve from being crushed in a whale.
Mm. It's Project Hail Mary, but inside a whale. He's got somebody to talk to.
Yeah, it's buried, but in a whale.
He can talk to the squid. Is the squid okay?
The squid is not okay.
Oh my God.
I mean, spoiler
what, mentally
squid.
Or?
Not here's that six squid. Not amazed. Looks good though, and
a
bold undertaking from Brian Duffield. So I'm very, very excited about that. Very, very quickly as well, Naomi Aki is in final talks to lead David Robert Mitchell's It Follows sequel, Lay Follow. She's going to be starring alongside Micah Monroe. The final talks to lead thing, I hope, doesn't mean what I think it means vis-a-vis Michael Monroe's character, who I suspect will not make it past the first 10 minutes of this movie.
Yeah. They follow, though.
They follow.
They follow.
Yeah.
They've taken the aliens approach to this, except without the dollar sign. Do we need more sexually transmitted phantoms? I don't know.
I mean, one was enough. Had one.
Yeah, but that was enough. Like, do you need multiple ones? I think one was terrifying.
James, don't look right now, but there's something behind you.
I can't see anything.
Yeah, if he can see it, that's okay.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm a goner, Rhea.
Oh no. They've figured out a way to continue it, because this is what, this 10 years old or something? It's been a while.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it walks very slowly, so it's been pursuing them for a decade.
It does, but I think, you know, they must have an idea, because otherwise, why go back to it? Because even as Scary Movie pointed out last week, not that many people saw this film, so relatively speaking.
That's true,
so,
but it was a great film.
Yeah, this is one of the kind of the first elevated horrors, really, wasn't it?
Along with
things like The Babadook and whatnot, but it's a really good film. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. It's got a really good ending as well. So I'm excited about that. I hope it's Naomi Aki and Micah Monroe in that, and I hope that they don't, David Robert Mitchell in this case, of course he wrote and directed the first one as well, doesn't succumb to usual horror part two survivor bump them off in the first 10 minutes syndrome. Anyway, that's good stuff. Should we have a guest?
Hurrah!
Shall we have David Kep?
Ooh.
Because this week, in fact, it's out in this country already this week because of the World Cup, I presume. I assume that's why it has opened, and that is why the release schedules are a wasteland of the next few weeks in this country. Some big movies aside, of course. But yeah, the new Steven Spielberg film, Disclosure Day, has opened in cinemas in this country. If you're listening to this in the States, it'll be opening today as you're listening to this. And it's very, very exciting. And it's Steven Spielberg tackling the possibility of extraterrestrial existence once again, as he has done in several of his movies. He and David Kep go back a long way as well. Kep wrote the first Jurassic Park, and indeed the second Jurassic Park, and indeed the most recent Jurassic Park, also Jurassic World Rebirth. And they have collaborated many, many times. And Kep wrote this from a story that Spielberg himself concocted. And when Kep was in the country just the other day, I jumped at the chance to have him come into the old Empire Pod booth and sit down and have a chat. Now, we did talk spoilers as well, but not in this interview. So there will be a Disclosure Day spoiler special with David Kep coming up in the next 10 days to 2 weeks or so. But this is a non-spoiler chat, so you can rest easy. Here it is, David Kep disclosing about Disclosure Day. Do please enjoy. David Kep, writer of Disclosure Day, welcome back to the Empire Podcast. How are you?
Chris, I'm great. I'm delighted to be on the Empire Podcast. I love the Empire Podcast.
I am delighted to have you here, sir, and here in London celebrating the release of this fantastic movie as well. You must be pretty delighted.
I'm very delighted. It's great fun when you really love the movie.
Yeah.
It's fun when the movie's okay, but it's infinitely more wonderful when you love the movie, and I love this movie.
We can't talk about spoilers yet. We will be talking about spoilers at some point in our conversation. It will be clearly marked. Don't worry, listening at home, they will know.
I'll spoil lavishly.
But was there a point, because the way that this movie was made was quite unusual. Steven Spielberg came up with the story for Disclosure Day and then asked you to write it. What was that process like, and was there a moment during that process where you didn't love the movie, where the movie was a tough nut to crack?
At first, I didn't think I was writing the movie. Steven sent a treatment. It was about 40 pages long. And he said, have a look at this. It's this thing that I've been thinking about. It sort of burst out. So I read it and I thought, because he didn't say, have a look at this, I'd love you to write it, I assumed he would write it because, you know, he's a terrific writer and he's written a number of his films. And so I gave him notes the way you would, you know, I assumed he was sending it as a writer sends a writer another thing and says, what do you think of this? So I said, first of all, your ending is fantastic, so the movie's going to be great. Nobody ever said, hey, great ending, shit movie, though. The other way around.
Yeah.
But So I said, you know, I'm a little bit confused by this and maybe combine this guy and I think it takes too long to get to that and, you know, the usual notes that you'd send. Then he sent it back about a month later. He said he'd done some more work and what do you think of writing it? And I have to admit, in the month since then, it had been in my head.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was delighted. He said, would you like to write it? I said, I thought you'd never ask. but then the problem was, he said in this proved to be very true. He said, okay, great. So then it became official. I was going to write it. And he said, now he sent me back all the notes that I had written on his treatment, like the original email, and said, here, they're your problem now. So, yes, there was a moment where it was like, big talk, buddy.
Be careful what you wish for.
Exactly.
That's amazing. So, giving notes to Steven Spielberg, you said just there, you give notes in the usual way that you would to another writer. It's not often, of course, that other writer is arguably the greatest film director of all time. And obviously, you've worked with him for many, many years now. He is a friend now to you. But nevertheless, is there a moment when you think, hang on a second, how can I possibly give a note to Steven Spielberg? How has this happened?
There is a tiny voice in my head, louder at first, certainly louder 34 years ago when I met him to write Jurassic Park. A much louder voice then, but it's still there a little bit as I'm giving him a note, that little voice is just saying, how do you know? And it's got to be shouted down because Stephen, I remember him going to pains to make me feel comfortable when I was 29 years old and writing Jurassic Park, so that I didn't behave like a fan, but instead behaved like a collaborator. Yeah. And so when he comes back for repeat business, you say, okay, well, he must value my opinion. I certainly value my opinion. Mm. So I've got to act like that. The contents of your head at the moment are the property of Universal Pictures, so dump them out.
So you start writing the movie.
That's stolen from Barton Fink, by the way.
Of course it is. I thought I recognized him.
Credit everywhere.
No, steal. Steal, David. Do not credit anyone. So you're writing the movie. And does Stephen step back at that point to let you finish the screenplay, or is he checking in every couple of days?
At first, he steps back. So we go through the story, and I say, okay, I can't remember if I wrote it down at that point. I think probably I rewrote the treatment just in my own words to end with my changes. And I think he said, okay, that sounds pretty good. I think X, Y, and Z might be problems, but why don't you take a shot at it, and then we'll talk.
Yeah.
And then during the writing of the draft, he really does leave you alone. He said, call if you have any problems or questions, but basically I want to see what you think. And so that first draft is my time alone with it. And I always refer to it as doing my filthy creative business in private. You're really chewing with your mouth open trying to figure things out. And that part is very quiet. Once you give it to him, now the sleeves are rolled up. And on this one in particular, because it's his story and because it's really he has said, this is like the summation of what I have to say about Alien.
Yeah.
Then there's, he's all over it. It's his story. And Stephen is always focused, always. On this movie, it was five times the level of focus I've seen from him before. There was a period of about a year where he read the script every single morning and had notes every single day. We did so many drafts, and I realized early on, wow, the boss is super engaged on this. I got to up it a level. not that we ever phoned it in, but there was a feeling of the fourth quarter of a football game to the entire process.
Talk me through the process of writing the first draft for you. Did it change in this? Are you someone who vomits it out, or you do meticulously plan?
It's evolved over the years. I used to plan in more scrupulous detail than I do now. I mean, I write treatments. Those are quite detailed. They'll run 20, 25 pages. What I find even more useful, a treatment is really to just try to communicate your ideas to someone else.
Yeah.
And to try to get your thoughts on character down on the page. What I really find useful is, my good old fashioned 3x5 scene cards laid out on a coffee table.
Okay.
any table where I can look down. I hate putting them on a wall. It's terrible. You can't slide things around. I've tried push pins like you see in movies, and it all seems very romantic, but I hate it. How are you supposed to say, no, the scene at the store goes over here, and now I have to unpin it, and it's left a hole in the board, and I got to move it over here and move everything else down. It's useless. Slide them around on the table so that I can look at it. I do note, like, if there's if it's an action film or a suspense film or whatever the primary value of the movie is, a comedic film, mm-hmm. I tend to put a red X where I think that value is showing up. Okay. So if there's a suspenseful sequence, those have red X's on them, and I can look and see, is it spread out in the way that I feel good about? If it's an ensemble, I'll even put different colors for different characters to say, oh my God, so-and-so is blue. I haven't seen him for 40 pages.
Okay.
I used to do that in really scrupulous detail. But what I found, it kind of changed when I wrote my first novel, which would have been 6-7 years ago.
Mm.
And I felt this really liberating experience of, well, I need to write 50 pages to see how I feel about it.
Yeah.
And I learned the characters better. And then I learned what the characters might do and might not do.
Yeah.
And so I brought some of that to scripts in the last 5 years, where I have an outline, but it's loose and I'm allowed to diverge and
to play around with it. Yeah. So you said that, let's talk a little bit about the movie without delving into spoilers, obviously. You said that when Stephen first approached you, a month later, you couldn't get the movie out of your head. And that over time you thought, oh, I want to write this. What was it about that initial story? And I guess Stephen grappling with the idea of aliens for maybe the last time that lured you in?
Well, it occurred to me, I went and I watched, after I read it, it occurred to me, oh my, I think I see what he's doing here. So I wanted to go confirm it. So I watched Close Encounters again, which I didn't really need to do. It was just a joyful experience. It's one of my favorite movies. And I watched E.T. again. I didn't need to watch War of the Worlds again. And I thought, look what he's done. He's done three of these, yeah. three films on this subject matter. This will be a fourth. And every one of them has a strikingly different tone.
Yeah.
It's not just the tone of the film is different. The genre of the film is different. Yes, they have the similar subject matter. So I tried to figure out, well, how would I define each one of those? And I'd call Close Encounters a late 70s messy family drama paranoid government story.
Yeah, that's fair. That was categorized on Netflix.
It's wordy, but it's accurate.
Yeah, it's good.
It falls in line with the Pakula things of that era. Not as dark.
No, certainly.
More hopeful, but that's Stephen. E.T. is just a beautiful family drama and fantasy.
Yeah.
War of the Worlds, of course, is a horror movie. So this felt because of its compressed nature, it takes place over about 72 hours. 3 Days of the Condor immediately came to mind. It's hearkening back, I felt, to those 70s paranoid movies in a way. But there's an essential change, which is in the 70s, we were starting to say, hey, do you think our government might be lying to us?
Mm.
And 50 years later, we know they're lying to us. They lie about everything. Well, my government in particular lies about everything.
It's a surprise if they tell the truth.
Yes. Yeah. Good morning, they lied. They lie about things they don't need to lie about. But yeah. More than that, it's not just the government. It's social media. It's deepfakes. It's AI. Everything's a lie.
Yeah.
We acknowledge everything's a lie. We're looking for something that's true.
Yeah.
And so I thought that, I just, in that month between reading his first treatment, reading his second treatment, I said, oh, I think I have a handle on this. You know, I think I see what he's doing. I think I see how he might do it. I think how I'd like to help him do it. But too bad he's writing it himself.
How detailed was that Spielberg story? How much leeway did you have? Okay.
Well, I had, those are two different areas. It was quite detailed and I had quite a bit of leeway. Because Stephen will always say, oh, let me have a look at that and then we'll see. He really wants you to run with it.
Okay.
So there were areas that were extremely detailed and even written as intercuts, like the climactic scene of the movie, mm-hmm. the sequence of the movie, mm-hmm. Is in the movie largely as it appeared in the treatment.
Oh, okay.
That was, but then there are other areas where he was sort of saying, and then we'll figure it out, and you know, that kind of thing. So, but he's quite open to changes. He'll always let you try it, and then you'll have a reasonable conversation if he thought it was better the other way, or if he thinks this is something we should run with.
Talk me through that first meeting with Spielberg. You're 29 years old, and you're about to ride Jurassic Park.
Oh, well, there were two firsts. The first meeting,
Two firsts.
Don't nitpick. It's a nuanced point. The very first time I met him was because Martin Donovan and I had written Death Becomes Her,
yes,
which Bob Zemeckis was directing. And Martin and I weren't a team. We had teamed up for two movies at that point. But those movies represented pretty much the limits of our shared interests. So Stephen read it and said, this is unusual and cool, and I'd like to meet those guys. So Martin and I met him. Mm-hmm. Then some time went by, and I was working at Universal. I mean, months, not years. And I had been hired by Universal in an overall deal by Casey Silver, who was the head of production at the time, for which I'm always grateful. And Stephen was looking for someone for Jurassic, so Casey said, why don't you read it and come tell him what you think? Mm. And I think at that point, there was a lot of storyboards. They'd had a few scripts written. He wasn't, you know, didn't feel like they'd hit it yet. But he had, you know, like the T-Rex attack on the road.
Yeah.
He was storyboarded beautifully. It was just blanks for faces because he said, I don't know who's in it, but this is what happens in the sequence. So I read the book and went in and told him what I thought. I really felt, well, you got nothing to lose. You're throwing your hat in the ring for a big job. Mm. I loved the book. Mm. I was daunted by the science. One of the big ideas I pitched was to cut Ian Malcolm, which I did in my first draft. And Stephen said, okay, you tried that. Can we please have that guy back? Because Jeff Goldblum read some stuff from the book, and he's fantastic. And that was, I only cut him because it was too hard.
Yeah.
I can't handle this guy with his three-page math monologues.
They are a bit much. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the first meeting was, I felt it unlike all the other meetings I'd been doing in Hollywood at that point in my career, which was go in and tell them your ideas and hope for the best. Mm. And except in this case, it was with a filmmaker, you know, who more than anyone inspired me to want to do what I do. But you try to put that out of your head.
It just takes about 34 years.
It takes a while, a few decades.
And is that relationship still roughly the same now on this movie?
I feel that I feel more confident than I did. I feel more secure in the job. You know, early on, you always fear screenwriters, you may have read, we get replaced a lot.
Yeah.
So you're always worried about that, which actually is strangely liberating. If you know you could be replaced at any moment, you can say whatever you want. You might as well. So I feel confident that he's not going to fire me. And I feel more confident saying things that I think might be stupid or turning in a draft of something and saying, I don't think I have this.
Oh, okay.
Have a look and tell me what you think.
Interesting.
Which is not what you want to hear as a producer or as a director. You want to shove it back to the person and say, okay, why don't you give it to me when you do feel like you have it? I think that's it. What hasn't changed in the relationship is that, and about Stephen as a storyteller,
yeah,
is that his, I'm putting words in his mouth, you'd have to ask him, but I still think his favorite part of the process is making them up. Where I see him light
Sounds
up
right.
the most
yeah.
is, hey, wouldn't it be cool if?
Yeah.
And it's the same with Brian De Palma, by the way, who absolutely, that's the stuff they like. You can pitch an idea at him, like, hey, I found this piece of origami paper on the street. Do you think we could make a movie out of it? Well, we could fold it into a, maybe there's a whole bunch of origami paper on a truck and the truck's been stolen and that's the De Palma one. anyway, that has not changed about Stephen.
That's amazing. You're always trying to give him that Barton Fink feeling, David.
Yes.
That's from Barton Fink.
That was an easier one, but yes.
There was a clue
hidden
within the quote. One last thing, very, very quickly. You were announced recently as the writer of a new version of Westworld, which is a film I adore. Of course, there's the old Michael Crichton connection again. Can you say anything about that at this point? What's your take might be?
I could, but I won't. Because, well, it's terrible bad luck to talk about the ones you're still typing.
Okay.
And it also removes the desire to write them. If you, I've had ideas where I tell the idea to my wife, and then I tell the idea to a couple of my friends, and then I tell the idea at dinner one night when I've been drinking, and then I realize I never wrote that idea because it's just evaporated. I just talked about it too much. But I will say when I saw Westworld, the movie, because I love this, It was 73. It was 70. I would have been 10.
Yeah.
Possibly 9. And my Uncle Mike, I went to stay with my Uncle Mike and Aunt Mary in Chicago. Uncle Mike was a very tough guy. He'd been in, 5 years in the infantry in World War II. I mean, there was no more manly man than Uncle Mike. And he took me and my cousin to a double feature of Westworld and Soylent Green.
Oh, wow.
In downtown Chicago. And I scared the living shit out of me. And I cried that night because I was so terrified. And I just felt like Uncle Mike was disappointed in me. But Westworld was so imprinted on my brain, particularly the first hour before it becomes a bit chasey.
Yeah.
And it was just such a great idea, such a stroke of science fiction genius.
Yeah,
and there's plenty. It's only more relevant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. I look forward to talking with you about that down the line.
I look forward to the script existing.
Well, I look forward to that as well. That will be a lot of fun, and of course, so good that Crichton essentially took that idea and said, "I'll add dinosaurs to that."
Yeah, that was a. That was a very nice adaptation of his own idea.
He did very, very well indeed.
It worked out.
David Kep, always a pleasure. Should we talk spoilers?
Yes, let's.
Let's do it. Oh, thanks very much indeed. All right, that was David Kep talking about Disclosure Day. And now it is time for us to review Disclosure Day because it is the reviews section of the show. Hell's Bells.
Hurrah.
You love a bit of Spielberg.
I do.
So what did you make of this one?
Very positive overall. This is the story of... Well, we kind of join it almost like mid-scene, like mid-action. But Josh O'Connor plays Daniel Kellner, who has absconded from his workplace with a bag full of secrets and is now being threatened, basically. His former co-workers have kidnapped his girlfriend and told him, you either give us all that stuff back or we're going to do something terrible to his girlfriend, played by Eve Hewson. Meanwhile, a weather woman... who is played by Emily Blunt, Margaret Fairchild, starts having strange experiences and finding herself with unguessed at skills and has to figure out what exactly is going on. And behind both of them, there is a sinister figure played by Colin Firth, who is trying to track down Josh's character and keep control of some kind of situation that isn't initially clear, while Coleman Domingo's Hugo is trying to... coordinate an opposing plan. I think it's pretty clear from the early on. Look, the joy of this film genuinely is trying to piece all the bits together, because this is not spoon-fed A to B cinema. You kind of join it around the letter J and then it kind of races through the rest of the alphabet, right? I mean, it's just sort of you're kind of sitting there for the first little half going, okay, what's going on? You will know from all of the, the publicity, everything that's been announced about this film, that it does concern aliens, that the title, as the kind of trailer made clear, refers to the idea that, okay, this is the day where we reveal the existence of aliens to the world.
Which is something that UFO experts or UAP
experts, as they, I think they like to call themselves right. these days, they've long dreamt of this day. They think that right. this
think
day
it's
will
a real,
happen.
It's a real yeah. thing. Yeah, yeah, for them, it's a real thing. So for these characters, it's very much a real thing, a real possibility as well. And basically, that's kind of about as much as you want to know, I think, plot-wise. Mm. That you just go in, focus on it, and let it happen around you. There's lots of talk about the device and, you know, the passenger and the experiencer and all these kind of terms. It doesn't matter if you don't know what those are. Just pay attention to the story.
And given that they don't really explain them, you never will know.
Yeah,
but that's
quite right, actually.
For the good.
Yeah. And that is for the good. I think this is not sort of the usual kind of spoon-fed, you know, designed to be watched on a second screen kind of storytelling. It's very much designed to be seen in the cinema with a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah.
And I think it's all the better for it. I have some quibbles. There were moments, and we'll talk about them, I'm sure, in the spoiler special. There were yep. moments of character work where I would have liked either something different or something more. There were moments where I would have liked just a tiny bit more explanation story-wise or a tiny bit more clarity of certain things. But generally speaking, I was just completely delighted by its Spielberginess, by the way the story is told, by his just ease and facility with the camera and the way that he can just, you know, put the camera at a really low angle next to a car and make closing a car door seem thrilling. Do you know what I mean? Like, the way that characters sometimes behave in ways that make no sense. There is a moment where Josh O'Connor does something and you will be screaming, it maybe internally if you're in the cinema, going, what are you doing, you idiot? Mm. And kind of, to be fair, he's kind of saying the same thing to himself and he's still doing it. But, you know, it's just so thrilling to watch because you don't know everything that's going to happen before it happens. You don't have that sense of, okay, now we're coming up for the, you know, now we're coming up for the sincere scene. Okay, now we're coming up for the twist. Okay, now we're going to find the bit where so-and-so betrays so-and-so or whatever. You know, it doesn't sort of just hit the usual marks in the usual ways. It feels like a 70s filmmaker.
Yes.
And it feels like a 70s film. It's been... There was some rumors going around last week that it's a sort of stealth sequel to Close Encounters, which it kind of is, but it isn't. Like, if you're expecting,
it isn't. I mean, fairly.
There's one shot. There's one shot where you could be like, recognize that. That's it.
Mm.
But the point is, it isn't a. It's not about that. It's about it's a sequel to a film made by that guy. It feels like that guy is making this film as well. It feels like it's, you know, also kind of American heartlands, sort of lonely farmhouses, back roads, countryside. It's a very American movie for a movie that is supposed to be about everything in the world.
With everyone in it being basically British.
And everyone in it is British. But yeah, apart from Coleman Domingo, basically, but in the central cast. But, you know, it only concerns itself with stuff that's happened to Americans and stuff that's happened in America in terms of the UFO-y stuff that it discusses. But that's because I think it's him looking at America right now. In the same way that War of the Worlds was his 9/11 film, I honestly think this might be his Trump film. I think this is a film about dysfunction in America. And that's my big pitch. I will discuss that more in the spoiler special, but
yay!
fun!
Looking forward to that.
But I just thought it was magnificent. I think this is what I mean about it feeling like a 70s film. It feels like a film that's something to say about the world. It's not something that's just hitting the beats that a studio exec has mandated. It just feels like it's kind of loose and flowing and just coming from an auteur filmmaker.
Yeah, well, it has zero studio interference. I think that's something that comes across very clearly. And as you said, like, you feel like you're in uncharted territory from the beginning. Like, you don't know where it's going to go. You have no idea where they're going to end up next. The characters make terrible decisions, as people do. I think what surprised me most about this is it didn't feel like what I thought it would be, which is a big tentpole summer blockbuster, because it is a conspiracy thriller. It's very adult storytelling. And I don't mean because there's like lots of violence or nudity or anything, just it's very cerebral. It's quite thinky. It's about questions more than answers. It's quite deliberately paced as well, to a point where I wondered whether certainly younger audiences might not quite know what to make of it, because it doesn't feel like it's aimed at the kind of like 13-year-old audience. It feels like it's really like a thinking person's quite adult
summer film.
You say
that, but then something like Backrooms is doing incredibly well at the box office. Now, it's tracking relatively soft, I think, at the moment, so I don't know how it's going to do at the box office, but I think it deserves to find an audience's thing, because I was just like, this is such a weird movie.
It is.
To exist in the summer space, you know?
Oh, which 100%, is, yeah.
And it's so weird and it's unpredictable and I had very, very little clue of where it was going apart from one thing that I guessed. And I honestly had a great time with it.
Yeah, I really liked it as well. It just as I say, it wasn't what I expected to be, and I don't know what it'll do at the box office. I worry it won't do super well because, again, it's not a big explosive blockbuster. It's not, you know, like a four quadrant film. It feels like it doesn't really have that much to offer a younger audience. But, you know, and let's be honest, adults are often starved of large, big budget blockbuster entertainment. You know, for a kind of traditional adult storytelling, you often have to turn to streaming services and TV shows. And this gave me something that I felt like I hadn't received in quite a while. And I really enjoyed it. And also, you know, clearly Spielberg's best film since War of the Worlds. Don't at me.
I will absolutely at you. Get out of here. But whatever.
I'm
all is forgiven for West Side Story.
It's interesting. There's a thread running through the movie as well about religion and faith, and there's a moment where the film almost becomes a horror film, which is really interesting. I'm very much looking forward to the spoiler special here, and about what would happen if the knowledge that aliens existed was revealed to the world. What would that throw the world into sort of a theological meltdown? How would certain faiths, how would people react to that news? Would they see it as proof of God's existence? And he's just, you know, we're not alone in the universe. There are other supreme creatures on different planets other than this. Or would they see it as proof that God doesn't exist? And what would that do to our society? Those are really, really interesting questions. And the idea of faith is something that I was thinking as well, because I have slowly, over the last few years, been losing my faith as a Spielberg fan. And this has got me back on board. This is a man who's approaching his 80th, well, he's in his 80th year, technically. He's 79. And this is one of those movies, you know, like Miller with Fury Road, like Ridley Scott with pretty much everything he does, where you get these guys, you're kind of showing the young whippersnappers how it's done. Some of the visual storytelling in this is incredible. The performances are brilliant. Emily Blunt is astonishingly good in this. She is asked to do a lot of very, very tricky stuff in this movie. It is my favorite Spielberg movie in quite some time, and it's good to have you back, sir.
He's never been away. You're both mad. But it is a really good movie.
All right. We gave this one 4 stars. I'm very, very much looking forward to discussing this on the spoiler special. So that'll be a lot of fun. We'll say Eve Hewson, technically Irish.
I wasn't including it. When I said the British, I did think that. I thought I wasn't actually thinking of her when I said it. I was thinking
Josh
Colin
Firth, and Emily.
Josh, yes. Emily Blunt. And then I was like,
Not just technically Irish, definitely.
She's 100%
Irish.
Full
Irish.
She's not remotely British. But that, to be fair, I was not referring to her.
Well, listen, it's a cracking film. I would recommend very, very highly you go see it. I realize the World Cup is on as of this week, and I realize that the timings pretty much clash with when people go to the cinema. A lot of games run at 8 p.m. and whatnot, but fine time to go see Disclosure Day.
Matinee screenings,
absolutely. 4 stars in for Steven Spielberg's Disclosure Day. Up next is a film that was knocked down gingered on Prime Video today, as a matter of fact. It came out in the States a couple of weeks ago. It is a new film from Jorma Taccone, and it's called Over Your Dead Body. And Jimbo, having now seen this, I believe that you would see it again over your dead body.
Yeah,
is that
I feel it lives up to the title a little bit. This is obviously from the man who did Popstar Never Stop, Never Stopping, which you, of course, love.
Yes.
Great film.
Yes, indeed. I wish he'd never stopped. No. I wish he had stopped. Stop. I don't know. I wish he hadn't made this, is what I'm saying.
I wish you'd never started. Never starting.
I wish I'd never started talking about this. So this sees Jason Segel and Samara Weaving as an unhappily married couple who go for a getaway at a sort of a cabin, not so much in the woods, but by a lake, where he plans, unbeknownst to her, instead of having a romantic getaway, to murder her and hide the body and pretend that she died in a freak hiking accident.
Murder.
For the first half hour, maybe 40 minutes of this, that's what this film is. It's kind of a black comedy of the two of them bickering and him scheming on how he's going to kill her. And it's actually pretty decent at that point. You think, okay, this could be quite a really fun pitch black comedy. Except there is a secondary storyline whereby two murderers have escaped from prison, Timothy Oliphant and Keith Jardine, and Juliette Lewis is a guard who's helped their escape, and they are apparently in the wild. But of course, they get embroiled in this whole situation. And once they appear, this whole film becomes deeply, deeply stupid, while also being quite acutely unpleasant. Partly because it's incredibly gory at times, while not being a horror, like it still thinks it's a comedy, but it's really unpleasant. And also, there's a really disturbing streak of rape humor in this that they seem to find outrageously funny and yet is wildly not. So it manages to be offensive and yet boring and kind of mal-executed and ill-thought through. And there's a ping-ponging chronology where they keep doing kind of flashbacks to 3 days earlier in a Rashomon star to show it from another perspective. And honestly, I just wish they hadn't.
Yeah, I feel like the 3 days earlier or 6 days earlier, whatever thing, could have worked well, if the rest of it had continued to be in the tone of those first scenes and had continued to be that kind of, like you say, quite black comedy. But it gets too dark to be funny, but without being so dark that it becomes funny again. Mm. You know, it just falls between the stools. And it's just not, the characters aren't good. I think they're trying to do a sort of thing where the escaped, certainly one of these great criminals, the Timothy Olyphant character and the Juliet Lewis character, who are kind of in a relationship, which is how she helped them escape. You know, they're trying to have them reflect our main couple of Dan and Lisa, but it doesn't work and it doesn't really help anything, and it's just distracting. And pretty much everybody involved is better than this and has done things like this better in the past. And so it's just really disappointing. And I was really in it for that first sort of 30, 40 minutes. I was like, this is really fun. I can't believe they dumped this on Prime. And by the end, I was like, oh no.
Yeah. It's also all the characters are somewhat loathsome.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Don't watch it.
Sorry.
I had a good time.
Ah, there's always one.
Hello. It's me. I'm the problem.
It's 2 stars, generously.
Yes, it is.
I would say there are 4 stars. There's Timothy Olyphant, Jason Segel, Samara Weaving, and Juliette Lewis. Oh, and then your bloke from Paul Guilfoyle.
Yes, from CSI.
I always give anything an extra star when Paul Guilfoyle from CSI and The Negotiator is in it. Wow. And LA Confidential. Oh, what a man. What an actor. What a legend. 5 stars then for Over Your Dead Body.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We didn't like that one, but Hell's Bells, did you like Peter Mullen in The Fall of Sir Douglas Weatherford?
This, God bless you if you can remember this title.
I genuinely just did.
I know you did. Well done. But only because we've been talking about it at the start of the show. I went to the cinema to see this on Monday for a screening, and I arrived at the same time as 2 other critics, and we were all like, it's the something of Sir something something, and they let us in. God bless. Anyway, this is written and directed by Sean Dunn, and it is kind of a dark comedy again. I think it's a bit more successful, a little bit. So Peter Mullen plays a widowed Scottish man called Kenneth, who is a tour guide in a Scottish town, and he is very proud of their native son, Sir Douglas Weatherford, who in this telling is a, you know, inventor, anatomist, philosopher, economist. Like, he was a sort of Renaissance man, and Kenneth claims ancestry, ancestral ties to this figure, and is extremely proud of him and gives tours and talks about his influence. And that's all well and good until a Game of Thrones style show called The White Stag of Emberfell that I would 100% watch turns up in this small town and starts shooting. And basically, almost immediately in this telling, the entire town is overrun with nerds who only want to hear about Emberfell and get their picture taken with the star of that show. And Kenneth is kind of displaced, and he goes along with it at first, and he's trying to play nice, but he's just getting more and more discouraged and becoming more and more embittered against the show. And it's clearly building to some kind of action that he's going to take against the show. You've also got Gail Rankin as his daughter, somewhat sort of, she's just exasperated with him and thinks he needs help and he won't take any help, and she's just kind of at her wit's end with him. And anyway, that's kind of the setup. It is a very gentle, very small film. It's obviously a brilliant Peter Mullen performance, no questions there, but it kind of doesn't go very far, very fast. It's nice. I had a nice time. And I thought it was at one point going to go really dark in the sort of, you know, Over Your Dead Body styly. It doesn't go quite that far, but it goes further than maybe you would expect. But I thought it was an interesting look at how maybe the things we value in the world and how those are changing, and also just how someone who is lonely and grieving can, you know, hang their entire personality on one little thing, and if that is taken away, can react very, very badly. So I think there's real substance to it, and there's a real kind of melancholy and kind of sweetness to it. But at the same time, it's not, you know, it's not going to change the world. I find it interesting also that Gil Rankin and Peter Mullen have both been in shows like this.
Yes, yes.
House of the Dragon and the Lord of the Rings, for them both. So that was kind of a funny little side. But yeah, I just thought it was nicely done.
Nicely done. What do you give it?
I think it's a 3. For me.
All right, excellent. 3 stars down for The Fall of Sir Douglas Weatherford, which is in cinemas this week, but will be on Mubi in a few weeks' time.
All right.
I guess. Over here, Dead Bodies on Prime, and Disclosure Day is in cinemas.
Very exciting.
But on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by... It is... Despite the World Cup, there is a big film coming out next week. It is Toy Story 5. Woo-hoo. It's the return of Woody and Buzz.
And Taylor Swift is on the podcast. Oh my God, amazing. I'm so excited.
No, we have Tom Hanks and Tim Allen, who of course are Woody and Buzz. Sorry to harsh your Buzz and possibly also to kill your Woody.
Oh no.
Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my 2 colleagues of such lethal cunning, one of whom has to get the train imminently.
Choo-choo.
Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris. Listen to the Pilot TV podcast, for Javier Bardem is on this week. Lissan Al Gaib.
Oh my God. Did you interview him?
Yes.
Did you ask him anything about Cape Fear?
It was all just June questions. Chat, yeah.
You let Dougal to a funeral.
It's true.
Oh, it's very, very bad indeed. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to prepare for next week's exciting announcement. They're going to love it in Utah.
Oh, no.
Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.